WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey everybody, welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. The word unprecedented is used a lot these days when talking about the news and frankly the current administration. But do not be fooled. In the past, the presidency has been engulfed in chicanery equally as jaw-dropping as some of the actions we've seen in the past few years. It's just that scandals evolve in real time. They don't explode like firecrackers. They drip like candle wax. One podcast that understands this is Slate's Slow Burn. It looks at the twists and turns behind some of the most tumultuous times in American history. Season one focused on Watergate, and season two is all about the Clinton impeachment, and the finale of season two is out today. Leon Neyfakh is Slate staff writer and the host of Slow Burn. Welcome, Leon.
Thank you.
All right, we want to get our callers involved in this as well. We want to hear from you. What are your memories of the Clinton impeachment? Do you remember how it was covered in the media? How about the Watergate scandal? Or maybe you have some ideas for your Leon to consider for the future seasons of Slow Burn.
Please, yes.
Give us a call, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. We'd love to hear from you. Okay, what qualifies as a slow burn? When you guys were considering what this podcast was going to be about.
Well, so I think with the first season, one of my first sort of revelations when I started reading about Watergate was that it took quite a long time, you know, 2 years and 2 months, I believe, between the burglary and the resignation. And I think for a lot of listeners who absorbed that show, that felt like some reassurance, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, these things, you know, particularly liberal listeners who would like to see something happen with the current administration, they think, well, you know, 2 years is quite a long time. These things take time. With this new season, we wondered if, you know, is Slow Burn really the right name for it, given that, you know, the Lewinsky story broke in January of 98, and then, you know, sort of all wrapped up by the early part of 99, when Clinton was acquitted in the Senate. However, as I started trying to tell the story, I realized you can't really explain how the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal unfolded without going back all the way to Arkansas, where you had the Whitewater scandal that came up that caused there to be an independent counsel appointed. You can't really explain it without the Paula Jones lawsuit, which was in, you know, a story that began in 93. And so that actually turned out to be a much slower burn than the first season.
I'm obsessed with Watergate. If you go to my Twitter page, Al Stewart, it says, as a pencil, it said, I stole this from the Watergate.
Oh, yeah. I have one of those, too.
Of course you do. I'm curious, just in terms of making the podcast, who did you envision your audience to be? Were they people who lived through it? Were they people who were too young to remember it as for Watergate and for Clinton?
Yeah, it's a great question that we asked ourselves a lot, because you sort of have to make guesses or assumptions about how much your audience knows. You know, what facts or plot lines are you going to present as novel or as, you know, forgotten, or what are you going to treat as conventional wisdom? So we sort of tried to just create as big a tent as we could, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, we wanted to not treat anything as obvious, even for people who lived through it. I think we were able to sort of surprise them with things that they've forgotten. As for people who didn't live through it, I think a lot of the stuff was new to them. And even, you know, for me, I was in eighth grade when the Clinton impeachment happened. And I don't think I knew much of anything. You know, I remember being confused about why is it that he got impeached, but he's still president? How does that work? That's a question we answer in the show.
I'm smiling because I think I was your age during the Clinton impeachment. So it was a young reporter, and it was this weird, exciting, strange thing. And then I remember Nixon. I was like six, but I remember my mother making me come in to watch on a little black and white TV Nixon resigning. She's like, this is history. Yeah. You have to watch this. And it's burned in my memory because I was trying to play outside.
Yeah, we definitely talked to a lot of people who were kids during the Senate Watergate hearings. And they remember like watching TV and being like, you know, told by their parents yeah. to tune in for sure.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the first season, because you start with the story of Martha Mitchell, who I think for some people may have been a footnote, but was really, really significant and important. Explain to folks who Martha Mitchell was. And I'm also curious what you think she would have been like today or who is she? Who would be her equivalent?
That's
today?
The question. Yeah. So Martha Mitchell was the wife of Nixon's attorney general and also his campaign manager for the re-election, John Mitchell. And Martha Mitchell was this extremely famous sort of, I guess, political wife. Like, that was not really a category in 1971, 72. Like, there weren't, you know, people's wives weren't famous.
They weren't
Washington.
Like professional first
yeah,
wives, right?
She could have had no profile whatsoever, but she was so charming and charismatic and outspoken. Like, she would go on TV and say things that people, you know, couldn't believe came out of her mouth about, you know, I think she was actually very anti-liberal. She was very, like, eager to put down, you know, the communists who hated the Nixon administration. But she just carried herself with a sort of Southern, like, glamour that people really, I think, responded to. And I was shocked to see some poll that said that, you know, before Watergate, her name was known to like 70%+ of the American population, which is mind blowing, because people of my generation don't really know who she is. And so what happened, the reason we focused on her in the first episode of the last season, is that she, you know, was suspected by the Nixon people of knowing too much about Watergate, because she, you know, she was married to the campaign manager. She was in the house when he would have meetings.
And she liked a cocktail.
And she liked, yes, that's a crucial point. She did. she liked, you know, she was known for liking to drink. And she was known for being a gossip. And she was known for having friendships with reporters. And so there was
that's a combination.
Exactly. So the fear was that she would, you know, say something to the wrong person about what she knew about Watergate before they were really ready to, you know, to answer the charges, so to speak. And so that first weekend after the break-in, they, you know, a couple of guys who were her minders, basically, you know, kidnapped is too strong a word, but they basically neutralized her. They made sure that she wasn't talking to anyone. They pulled the phone out of the wall so that she wouldn't call her, you know, so she wouldn't tell her friend Helen Thomas at UPI about what she knew. And they finally injected her with a sedative. And for, you know, for the couple of years after that, she was, you know, she would talk about how she had been silenced. And she really you know, suffered for it.
And one of the great notes of it, which is, I think, one of the really interesting, fun things about both seasons, is there are people, players from then who we know are involved in the political spectrum today. So this guy, Steve King.
Yeah. So actually, one confusing thing is there are actually now two Steve Kings on the scene.
That's true.
So this is not the guy from Iowa, right? He's from Iowa, right? I think
he's
it's
from somewhere.
So this is a guy who's an ambassador now, and he was. He was with the FBI at the time, and he was, according to reports, the one who was sort of overseeing Martha's captivity.
And he is the current ambassador on the Trump administration, too.
I'm blanking on it. It's been too long.
We'll get it. Somebody will Google that first. Hey, give us a call at 212.
My head's been in Clinton too much.
Exactly. 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. We want to know about your recollections of Watergate, how it unfolded, how it played out in the media. Same for the Clinton impeachment. And if you have any ideas for Leon to consider for the future seasons of Slow Burn, 212-433-9692. Was there an unsung hero of Watergate that you discovered, or even sort of an unknown villain?
Oh, interesting. Well, I'll answer the first one first. I think the thing I discovered in particularly as I was looking for people to interview, you know, one thing we found was that we had much better luck sort of getting access to people who were sort of on the periphery of the story. And if not on the periphery, then they were staff, you know, like we didn't talk to senators who presided over the Senate Watergate hearings, but we talked to people who worked for them. And so in episode four, sort of the two heroes of that episode are a married couple, Mary DiIorio and Mark Lakritz, who worked on the Democratic side as investigators. You know, those the people who figured out what to ask everybody. You know, you see this sort of choreographed, you know, hearing unfold on TV and all these senators asking questions. The reason the senators know what to ask is because they have these, you know, these staff members who do the investigation. and tell them, you know, here's what we need to get out of this person. So I would cite them.
As unsung heroes.
Yeah.
What about villains?
The question was unsung villains?
Yeah. not bold-faced named villains.
Yeah, well, I think older listeners will scold me for suggesting that this person is in any way unknown. But the judge who oversaw some of the Watergate, many of the important, you know, hearings in the Watergate case, Judge Sirica, I wouldn't call him a villain, but he is an interesting person because some of the decisions he made ended up propelling the story forward. Like he was very aggressive against the burglars, and he was able to again sort of advance the plot in the vocabulary of the podcast. But at the same time, he has been criticized by civil liberties folks for trampling on the rights of the of those accused burglars. So I don't think that makes him an unsung villain, but he's a complicated figure.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, somebody who had an effect on the trajectory of the story, but you wouldn't necessarily think that they would be they would have that much significance, from his decisions.
Well, and so like he threatened James McCord, one of the burglars, with a very, very long prison sentence, and it's believed by historians that one of the reasons McCord ended up kind of coming forward and saying, listen, there were things during this trial that weren't said out loud, there were names that weren't uttered that are important, that this thing, you know, as the saying goes all the way to the top. He wrote a letter to Judge Sirica saying that, and I think it stands to reason that he did that because he felt that pressure of those, you know, 30 years in prison or whatever he was being threatened with. So, you know, is that how we want judges to behave? Not necessarily, but in this case, like it caused the story to break wide open.
I think people, you know, are obviously interested in Watergate again because of everything that's going on with the Mueller investigations. Do you think the comparisons are valid after doing all this research?
Between Watergate and Trump?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, one thing that I've sort of been turning over in my head is how much of it is coincidence, like, and how much of it is just a reflection of a kind of logic that operates in scandal, and also with the institution of the Independent Counsel's Office, right? Like, when you have a special prosecutor investigating the White House, certain things happen. So it's like they're already similar situations, right? When you have a special prosecutor investigating the president, and so, but yes, there are lots and lots of little subplots that echo things that we've seen in recent months and years.
For example?
My favorite was after Nixon released a bunch of transcripts of his secret White House tapes, members of the House Judiciary Committee who had heard some of the tapes saw that the administration had, you know, cleaned it up very significantly, and that this act of transparency in which the Nixon people, you know, released all these pages of transcripts had in fact left out very, very incriminating things, and they leaked, and someone on the House Judiciary Committee leaked those discrepancies to the press, and I believe it was Pat Buchanan, who was then working as a sort of spokesperson for Nixon, came out swinging and said, "The real crime here is whoever's doing this leaking. We got to investigate these leakers." These journalists who are writing about this, maybe they should think about the real crime here. And so when I heard that, I was like, gosh, this could have been said yesterday, you know?
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. What do you think about partisanship? I mean, obviously this was the Democrats versus the Republicans in terms of that was breaking was the Democratic headquarters. But was it partisan in the way that we think about it today?
The short answer is yes. Yeah. I mean, I think Watergate has been held up by some people as the last time our government, you know, as a time when our government really worked and the, you know, the story ended the way it was supposed to. Mm-hmm. Republicans were willing to turn on their president when they saw that he had committed all these misdeeds. But in fact, like, Nixon enjoyed support from not only Republican politicians, but from Republican voters. Almost to the very end. I mean, it was really that last, you know, the smoking gun tape that was released at the very end. It was, you know, a tape that showed that Nixon had essentially tried to sic one law enforcement agency against another and use the instruments of government to try to protect himself. And people heard that and they said, okay, like, we can't really defend him anymore. But up to that point, you know, it was definitely partisan and people were defending him because he was their guy.
We're going to be back with more with Leon Neyfug. He hosts the Slate podcast Slow Burn. Season 2 is available now. We're going to talk about the Clinton impeachment on the other side of this break. We want to hear from you, our listeners. What do you remember about the Clinton impeachment? Do you have memories of the way the media covered it? Give us a call. And later on the show, our regular series, Andy in the Archives. This is time of the week when WNYC's chief archivist, Andy Lancet, takes us back to yesteryear. Stick with us. All of it will be back after the break. And we're back with Leon Neyfug. He's the podcast host of Slow Burn. It's from Slate. Season 2 covers the lead up to and the aftermath of the Clinton impeachment. The season finale drops today. I haven't listened to it yet. It's in my feed. I can't wait to hear it. And we do want to hear from you. What are your memories from that time? So we were talking a little bit during the break. One of the things that you get into in the podcast and the whole Clinton impeachment is the aura around of the hatred of the Clintons, which I think a lot of young Americans don't really understand.
Yeah.
What was at the base of that hatred for Bill and Hillary Clinton?
So I was startled to find out how many little mini scandals there were in the Clinton White House during like the first year of the administration. And these mini scandals, you know, they had names like Travelgate. Troopergate was there, right. So there were some scandals that were sort of sex scandals.
Yes.
Troopergate was a sex scandal. And then Travelgate was more like a secrecy scandal, I would say, there was an aura, as you said, of distrust around the Clintons. And I think people felt like they were always trying to hide something. They were always trying to not answer questions. You know, Clinton himself was known for giving these very legalistic answers sometimes when he didn't want to answer a question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the most famous one, you know, came during the Lewinsky scandal when he said that he had not had sexual relations with that woman, and then he later explained that, you know, well, as I understood the term sexual relations, as it was laid out to me by the lawyers, I, you know, that was a true statement.
She had them with me, I didn't have them with her.
Precisely,
right?
Yes.
Okay.
And so I think people really resented their, what they saw as their secrecy and their sort of reflex to make themselves less accessible rather than more. And I think the Clintons in turn felt like, well, if we give them more, they'll just kill us more, you know. Like there was a question at one point of like, do we release all this documentation on Whitewater? Like, let's just put it out all on the lawn, on the front lawn, and let people dig through it. They're not going to find anything. There's nothing there. But if we do that, the risk is they'll find something they can make a scandal out of. And so there was this kind of mutual distrust between the Clintons and the people who hated them, where the result was that the Clintons really kind of became ever more inclined towards, I think, privacy or secrecy, depending on how you look at it.
You were able to get a lot of access to Linda Tripp.
Yes.
How did that happen? Is she just wanting to talk at this point?
No, not at all.
Because she talked a lot. For someone who didn't want to talk, she was open with you.
Yeah. So, I mean, it took some trust building. As I talk about on the show, I sort of called her. I cold called her. You know, I found her number and, you know, and I called her up. I didn't really expect her to pick up. Some of the numbers that you find, you know, in all these old directories, they're disconnected. And I remember distinctly sitting there at my desk and not really thinking she was going to pick up the phone. And then I heard her voice, which I recognized from, of course, the Tripp Lewinsky tapes. And she said immediately that she didn't want to be interviewed. Like, this was all a very long time ago. You know, she has a new life now that has nothing to do with the Clintons. But then we just sort of stayed on the phone. And I tried to, you know, I tried to be sincere and honest with her and to say that, look, like, I'm coming to this with as blank a slate as anyone could. Like, I have my, you know, priors where, you know, that I was honest with her about that. Like, I remember you being an iconic villain in 1998. I was raised in a Democratic household where, you know, my sense was that, you know, Ken Starr was the bad guy and Clinton was the good guy. And I was straightforward with her about that. And I told her that, like, I'm doing this project in part to kind of interrogate my own intuitions and to sort of see whether the story looks any different 20 years on. And I think that's what convinced her that I was worth talking to.
And she's very interesting in it because she's very aware that people think she's the bad guy
for sure.
Sort of luring Monica Lewinsky and recording their conversations and in one way being a confidant, but then also turning on her. Do you think she was bad news?
Glad Inch is bad news to Monica Lewinsky? Yes, absolutely.
But in a malevolent way, or the way she portrays it is that she's a true American.
Well,
she's a patriot.
And she says that she was protecting Monica Lewinsky, right? In her mind, she was doing this in order to interrupt this unconscionable thing that was happening, that Bill Clinton was doing to this young woman whom Linda Tripp saw as a child in a woman's body. That's how she described it. She said that she had a very motherly feeling towards her, and that she wanted to save her. And so I think a lot of people hear that and they're like, you wanted to save her, so you recorded her phone calls, manipulated her, and then turned the evidence over to a federal prosecutor. That's not how I would have done that. Yeah. But I think like her motivations are sincere. It's a hard thing to tease out at this point 20 years later, but from from talking to her for hours and hours and hours, at the very least she has absorbed those ideas and speaks and says them out loud from a place of sincerity.
She believes those to be she believes that to be true.
Let's
go to Diego in Sunset Park. Hi, Diego.
Thank you for taking my call and good luck with the new show. On the topic of Linda Tripp, Lindsey Graham, who's currently in the news, was a part of the impeachment proceedings, if I recall correctly. Was he calling for outrage against Linda Tripp or maybe locking her up the way he's criticizing the Feinstein committee there?
So I don't recall any specific moments when Lindsey Graham had addressed Linda Tripp, but I do know that during the impeachment proceedings in the House and later in the Senate, there was this question of whether or not Congress was going to hear from and hear about this woman, Juanita Broderick, who alleged that Bill Clinton raped her in 1978. And so there was this, and this is what the season finale of the show is about. There was this question of, will we be allowed to consider this allegation as part of impeachment proceedings? And Lindsey Graham, I think he had mixed feelings about it, but he definitely was interested. And I know he talked to Juanita Broderick on the phone at one point. And I know that he at least suspected at one point that there might be some connection between the impeachment articles, which had to do with obstruction of justice and perjury, and the Juanita Broderick allegations. Because the problem was, for the Republicans, this is a horrific allegation of rape, but what does it have to do with the reasons we're supposed to be impeaching this guy for?
Right.
And so I think Lindsey Graham was exploring ways in which there might be a connection.
You also interviewed Ken Starr.
I did, yeah.
How did you go into that? What was the information that you wanted to get from him? And then what did you ultimately get from him?
Well, I first reached out to him very early on because I knew he was obviously an important figure for us to hear from. And he kind of went, he seemed willing to talk, but then he kind of went quiet. And I figured out later what happened was he used to had a book to sell. And the book just came out. And I think once that publicity tour was revving up, he became more accessible. And so he came in as part of a press tour. Like, I think I talked to him like literally on the 20th anniversary of the publication of the Star Report. At that point it was pretty late in the game. And so I ended up using him actually very little on the show. Mm-hmm. We have a couple of clips of him talking about his religious background. Cause the show, the episode we did in which he's featured is all about kind of how the Christian right responded to the Clinton Lewinsky scandal and how certain religious leaders and religious political activists kind of portrayed Clinton as this immoral monster who can't be our leader because our children will conclude that you can lie and you can lie to your family and you can lie to the country and it's fine. And that was sort of the argument. And so I think some people at the time connected Ken Starr's religious background, which is that he's a very deeply Christian man, to sort of his zeal for prosecuting Clinton. And so that's something we talked about.
Let's go to Judah from Westchester. Hi, Judah.
Hi there.
Hi. What did you want to add?
Well, my formative years were definitely during the Watergate years. And my concern is a little bit about revisionist history. There's something that's coming into the nomenclature regarding the current situation with Trump. I've even seen Carl Bernstein say this, that the real heroes in Watergate were the Republicans. People forget that the Watergate process was about 2.5 years, and that the Republicans were vigorous defenders of Nixon for 2.5 years and blaming the press and and denying evidence. Where for 2.5 years, the feeling for the country was every day there was a particular lie. And the two good examples of this is the famous quote of "What did the president know, and when did he know it?" by Howard Baker, viewed as sort of a probing question on behalf of the investigation.
I think I know what you're about to say. It's one of my favorite facts about this whole thing. Go ahead.
In fact, is that was actually a strategy devised by the White House and the lawyers to compel the investigators to come up with a specific event that would constitute a high crime and misdemeanor. Because there are a lot of allegations about this payoff or that payoff. But what was the specific violation of the Constitution that Nixon was guilty of? So Baker, incorrectly, in fact, was in his obituary, is viewed as sort of a moderate, you know, helping the investigation along, when in fact he was a strong defender of Nixon for years.
Yeah, the question, what did the president know and when did he know it, was asked in a way skeptically, right? The point was that he didn't know anything. That was what they were trying to show.
That's exactly right. That was a specific. And with Gerald Ford, who is viewed as this avuncular moderate, he actually, again, for years, was strongly defending the Nixon administration, attacking the press on program, which was particularly odd because about 3 years earlier, he was the leader of an impeachment drive of Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas for absolutely no reason whatsoever other than they wanted his seat, and he was a liberal seat in the press. So the heroes of Watergate were not the ones who, at the very end, were faced with such compelling evidence that Barry Goldwater had to go to Nixon to tell him to resign. It was the press and the people who thought that something was wrong that actually carried out the ball for 2.5 years.
Judah, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
I do want to point out that you guys are doing live events,
yes,
right? You have one coming up in Washington on the 16th, San Francisco on the 23rd, and Portland on the 24th. New York is sold out, unfortunately.
Fortunately for you. New York is sold out, yes, fortunately for me.
So I have one more question. So your next season.
Yes. We don't know yet. We don't know yet what it's going to be.
Maybe it could be about a young reporter born in Russia. Comes to the United States when he's 5.
I don't know how much of an audience there is for that.
Telling Leon's life story. I don't know. Maybe the Americans. It was a big hit. I'm Leon Ifuk from Slate, excuse me, the host of Slow Burn. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to All of It with Allison Stewart on WNYC. Now it's time to take a trip through the station's archives with WNYC's chief archivist, Andy Lancet. New York City has long been a haven for refugees, and through its place at the center of New York conversation and as a city-owned radio station until 1997, WNYC has covered the different waves of refugees who have come to New York for the safety to live their lives and pursue their dreams. Andy is here, and he has brought some tape. Hi, Andy.
Hi.
So WNYC signs on the air in 1924, correct?
Correct.
Okay, prior to World War II, when U.S. immigration law didn't make much of a distinction between immigrants fleeing persecution from economic migrants. But that all changes after the war. How does that affect New York?
Well, obviously, we got a huge influx of European refugees at the time, not referred to as migrants or not generally even as refugees, but as displaced persons. And there was a program that highlighted some of their work to, in a sense, give them more of a human face to the survivors of the Holocaust. And this was music by New Americans.
Andy, I understand that airing around the same time, WNYC was broadcasting refugee-themed dramas. What was the Citizens Committee on Displaced Persons?
Well, the Citizens Committee was a group that organized around the passage or the pushing for the passage of the DP Act of 1948. This obviously was going to allow some 200,000 displaced persons from Europe get into the United States to have permanent residence. And so the committee was, again, trying to put a human face on this, the plight of these refugees, and explain to the American public what their situation was.
All right, we've got a little piece of tape. Let's take a listen.
You, I know we use them. Here's the kind of hooks that we have got in mind.
Now, these were more than just musical numbers, right? They were actual radio plays?
Sure, they actually did quite a few radio plays as well. These were dramatizations, again, meant to sway public opinion in favor of this legislation. At that time, they, in fact, didn't even use the term Holocaust or Holocaust survivors. They often spoke of survivors of the Hitler terror.
Another piece of tape you brought us is the story of a refugee from the Soviet Union. Let's listen.
Because 28 years ago, I myself was a displaced person, and at the age of 14, I arrived in USA, forced to start a new life because my country was taken over by the communists, and life became
Of course, this is a continuing issue, even in modern times. New York has seen a steady stream of refugees through the years, from the former Soviet Union to war-torn countries in the Middle East. We've been doing a lot of this reporting recently.
Exactly, and as recently as Brian Lehrer's program, making the comparison between Syrian refugees currently and displaced persons or Jewish and other European refugees of the past.
The most discussed moment from last week's Brian Lehrer show was when New York City Congressman Gerald Nadler said this in relation to Syrian refugees.
If it weren't for the anti-Semitic, xenophobic 1924 Immigration Act, maybe 2 million of the 6 million Jews who died in the Holocaust would have been in New York instead. We shut our doors to people in need when they were Jewish. We can't do that again.
There's been debate about...
And that was from 2015. So this issue is as relevant today as it was back then.
Well, certainly with all the stories of migrants in the Mediterranean and fleeing Northern Africa.
Andy, thank you for the history lesson through the archives.
Thank you.
WNYC's chief archivist, Andy Lancet. We'll see you next week. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Researching and prepping for a Michael Shannon interview is a challenge. This man has a lot going on. He's in a new movie called What They Had, about a family coping with Alzheimer's. He's in a new AMC series, Little Drummer Girl, based on the John Le Carré novels. He'll be in an episode of HBO's trippy anthology series, Room 104. Shannon has appeared in more than 60 films, more than 40 plays, all 5 seasons of Boardwalk Empire. Yet you found a moment to come visit us. Hi, Michael.
Oh, well, why not?
Right? It's noon on a Wednesday. Why not?
Yeah.
We were talking about this in the break because I wanted to make sure this was actually true. You were asked if you would ever play Donald Trump, and you said no. Of course, knowing your politics, the answer I'm assuming is no.
Well, I think the interviewer who was asking me that question at the time, we were talking about the notion of empathy, and I was talking about how over my career I've been able to have empathy for a variety of people that are not so empathetic, and so I think that's what the question, how the question arose. But, I don't see any need currently to do that. He's everywhere. I mean, you can't look anywhere without seeing him, so I don't know why anyone would make a movie about him at this point.
What do you think about his skills as a performer? Is he performing his presidency?
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that he's a very captivating figure. And he's capable of being entertaining to certain people. I think he covers all genres, you know. He's a comedy and a horror film all rolled into one. And a tragic drama. Yeah. He's like, you know, the only TV channel you need, I guess.
It is interesting to watch as he, as I know you're interested in politics, it's interesting to watch as he engages his audience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a way, it is a bit of theater, and he does play his greatest hits, and the audience sort of absorbs that.
Well, it's, I think, at least from my point of view, it's a question of getting people to look one way so they don't pay attention what's happening over there.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of very, very, very serious issues right now. I think paramount among them is the recent IPCC announcement that we really don't have much time left to save civilization, basically. And it's a little terrifying knowing that instead of trying to figure out how to solve that problem, he's just going from one rally to the next, talking about what a great job he's doing. And, you know, initially when he was voted in, I was quite angry, and I did say a lot of things that I know upset a lot of people. And I, from time to time, I feel bad about that. But my anger is really turning into fear, because this isn't a joke, and we have to do something. The world has to come together and do something about this right now. This is what some of the brightest and most dedicated scientists in the world have banded together to tell us. And I just don't see any indication that he's planning to address it in any way, shape, or form. Maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong.
What are you thinking about as we head towards the midterms, when you think about what could happen in the next month?
Well, I choose to be hopeful. You know, I have a family, and mm-hmm. I don't want to be down in the dumps. I want to have hope. It's a little disheartening, honestly, that even when the Democrats have had power, they still have done relatively little to solve the problems. They've taken some steps, but even most of these scientists will acknowledge that the Paris Agreement wasn't even barely enough to get the job done. And that was when Obama was running the show. So, but I think it's crucial, no matter what, to vote. And I plan on doing so, and plan on encouraging as many people as I can to do so as well.
It's interesting. As you were talking, we were busy Googling, and there was an interesting story on CNN recently that said the planet has only until 2030 to stem catastrophic climate change.
I have a daughter that will be 16 in 2030. I don't like the idea that during her sweet 16, she's going to be waking up every morning to news like that.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope that 16-year-old children wouldn't have to face a problem like that. And, you know, Trump, people forget that he has a young child, yeah. Barron. And I worry about him. What's the world going to be like for him? Does his dad plan to make sure that he's taken care of? I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe they're thinking if you have enough money, you'll be able to buy yourself out of the catastrophe. You'll be able to build some, I don't know, special bubble to live in or something. I don't know. I really don't understand the rationale. It's insane.
This is a clunky segue, but I'm going to make it. One of the movies I really enjoyed in was Elvis and Nixon.
Oh, thank you.
And of course, it's about that. Apparently, that picture is one of the most requested from the National Archives of
yes.
Richard Nixon shaking hands with Elvis Presley. When you were researching that role, why did Elvis want to meet the president so badly?
Well, you know, I spent a lot of time talking to Jerry Schilling, who was a very, very close friend of Elvis. The book that Jerry wrote was actually kind of a catalyst for the project. And even people that were very close to Elvis can only really speculate about what the true answer to that question is. I think Elvis, oddly enough, was always clamoring for respect. He was a beloved and adored figure in popular culture, but not necessarily a highly respected one. And respect in the sense of, you know, as a man, as an intellect, as somebody whose opinions and thoughts about things are considered valuable. But I also think he... I've heard some theories that I'm not entirely comfortable talking about, particularly on the radio. But I think more than anything, I think that's what I boiled it down to. It's just a sense of wanting to fit in. You know, he had a real respect for law enforcement, for the law, and I think he really liked probably really like Dixon. I mean, who doesn't want to meet the president? I mean, no matter who the president is, it's the president. In terms of that specific badge, I mean, you can go and see. He's got, if you go to Graceland, collections of his guns, his badges, all his decorations and various plaques he's gotten from different places. I think those all meant as much to him as his, you know, gold records, really.
He seems incredibly earnest about his desire to meet the president, and earnest in his sense of, like, I want to tell you what I think is good for the country.
Yeah. He was, you know, he was a real American through and through. Mm-hmm. I can't say I necessarily agree with all his ideas about things, but you can't deny his love for America and that he's a real American story, an American legend, and kind of personifies the best things that can happen mm-hmm. to us as Americans, I guess.
We're speaking with Michael Shannon. Michael, you've had so many projects going on. I want to run through a couple of them. And they're in, especially Fahrenheit 451 seems incredibly prescient and important as we talk about this moment, this talk mm-hmm. about this low information age. You played mm-hmm. Captain John Beatty in the HBO version. When you were working on the project, were you thinking about our politics today, or were you just kind of staying as an actor in that story?
Well, I think, you know, the genesis of that project, you know, it all started with the man who made it, Ramin Barani. All of his films, historically, have huge, I believe, social significance. He's an artist who is really striving to encourage dialogue about social issues and awareness of social issues. As an actor, you can't necessarily play a political stance. You have to try and come up with something a little more complicated, you know, a fully fleshed out human being. Captain Beatty is a very difficult character to play because he's almost two different people. He's a very different person in public than he is when he's by himself. Mm-hmm. And although I do think that may not be so uncommon in the world, I think there are a lot of people that put on a face to go and do their job and get their paycheck and then secretly, privately may have a different point of view than what they present to the world. And that can cause a lot of, you know, issues. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I, pardon me, I chose to just really think about him as a person. And what that experience is like for him. I did find myself, oddly enough, kind of relating to his point of view about knowledge being perhaps, if not dangerous, certainly a troubling thing for people to have. Because I do feel like most people's heads are stuffed with information that they don't have the slightest idea what to do with it, you know? How to solve it, fix it. I mean, I feel that way all the time. I know, at least I think I know so much about what's going on. I mean, it's hard to tell nowadays, but, and I'll be damned if I know what to do about it. So every once in a while I'd be like, oh, maybe Beatty's got a point.
Why is it hard to tell these days? Or why is it hard for you, I guess I should
Well, know. You know, I could say to somebody who doesn't believe in climate change, I could say, well, the IPCC said this. And they say, oh, yeah, well, prove it. Prove it to me. Because that's what they say. They say, I don't know those people. What do you know personally? You've seen it? You know what's happening? Well, look at the storms. Well, there's always been storms. Look at the droughts. There's always been droughts. There's always been fires. You know? You know, it's very hard to say without any doubt in my mind, this is a fact, an absolute fact. It is a tricky thing to do. I mean, it's something that people have struggled with for centuries, you know, philosophers and whatnot. I'm not a genius at any of this. You know, I do my job, which is acting, which on the, you know, the grand scheme of things is not probably one of the more significant careers a person could have. But I am bombarded with this information the same way anyone else is. And it's, you want to be able to say to somebody, yes, this is happening. I know this is happening, but people can punch holes in anything.
I'm going to disagree with you that acting is not an important profession and that the arts aren't important professions right now, especially right now, because culture is such a vehicle for understanding each other, for talking about important issues, for illuminating important issues, and you need good, smart practitioners to do it.
I appreciate that. And look, you know, acting really kind of saved me. I'm not quite sure what I would have done otherwise, although it probably would have been artistic because I was also into music as well. But in terms of something that can have a real concrete impact, you know, I'm not going to be able through my acting to stop climate change. I can't do that. I can't do a role so well that the earth stops getting warmer, you know. And that's what I want more than anything.
Well, you could play Al Gore.
I could play Al Gore. Right.
In a fictionalized Inconvenient Truth.
Yeah, right. And I admire what he did there, too. I just saw Fahrenheit 11/9 the other night. I love Michael Moore, all these voices out there that are, you know, trying to grab us by the lapels and shake us up.
Let me ask you about this movie, What They Had, because it's you know, we've been talking about these giant macro issues, but the micro issue of a family dealing with someone with Alzheimer's. You play the son, Nick. He's a piece of work a little bit.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about Nick and how he is existing in this family.
Well, yeah, the story is basically there's a father and a mother, patriarch, played by Robert Forster and Blythe Danner. And the mother is in the early stages of Alzheimer's or perhaps dementia. She's losing her memory, basically. Mm-hmm. And there's a brother and a sister. I'm Nick. And then Hillary Swank is playing my sister. And she's moved away. She's out in California raising her own family, living her own life. I've stayed behind in Chicago. And I've taken it on the cause of taking care of the folks. And it's somewhat at my own expense. I don't take great care of myself. I'm starting to, I don't know, get my act together. I've opened a little bar. But I'm still very stressed out and anxious about what's happening with our mother. And you know, that's something that people do. I think it's one of the themes in the movie is sometimes rather than take care of ourselves, we focus on trying to take care of other people, and then we use that as an excuse for why we aren't able to take care of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the predominant themes, I think, in the movie. But it's such a rich tapestry. The writer-director, Elizabeth Chomko, based the film on her own family, and she really astutely draws this picture. You know, you would think, well, if you're just basing something on your own family, that would be easy, right? But it's actually it's a very difficult thing to do, and she does it very well, I think.
And it's so intimate. And so of a family, and you're sort of experiencing this with the family. So I'm wondering about like a role like that for you, and then versus something like In the Shape of Water, which is big and bold and out there. Mm-hmm. This is not an unfair question. Do you have a preference for those kind of, or is it where you are in your life?
Wow, you know, I can really say no BS, honestly. I loved making both of those films so much. I love both of those directors, both of the casts. It would be so hard to say I preferred one to the other. Not, I don't think it's an unfair question, and I understand why you're asking it. For me, I appreciate variety. I appreciate being thrown into surprising and challenging situations. You know, I never thought in a million years that someone would ask me to play an Israeli Mossad agent.
Little Tremor and then, Girl.
And then there I am with my, you know, Korean director friend, Director Park, playing an Israeli Mossad agent. And
some fabulous eyewear.
Yes, right. But it's just that's just one great example about how this career can just zigzag you in so many different directions that you could never see coming.
What's next? You said you had a little bit of time off.
Yeah, I think I'm going to start working on this really great murder mystery. Actually, it's really fun script by Ryan Johnson. It's called Knives Out. I think we're going to start shooting that in November. So the cast is still coming together, but that's what it looks like. It'll be my next job.
Yeah, that was the rumor in Variety yesterday.
Yes.
So it's true.
Yes, it's a true rumor. I mean, you know, you never know until you're there and the camera's rolling, but that's the plan anyway.
All right, when that's done, will you come back and talk to us about it?
Of course, anytime.
Michael Shannon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We will be right back after the break.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.